It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement is ramping up arrests in the Milwaukee area, and city leaders say ICE agents are violating local ordinances.
The U.S. Department of Homeland Security said in a statement Tuesday that agents had arrested 39 people across Wisconsin in, quote, targeted operations to apprehend people in the U.S. illegally.
That number has not been independently verified, but the Wisconsin immigrant rights group Voces de la Frontera has confirmed a surge in reports of ICE arrests, especially in and around Milwaukee.
In just a bit, we'll hear from a Milwaukee alder about how the city's Common Council is responding to these developments.
But first, we're joined by Christine Newman-Ortiz, founding executive director of Voces de la Frontera. Christine, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
So, Milwaukee Common Council saying there's this elevated ICE activity in the city. What is your impression of the scope of these targeted operations by ICE?
There had been already an uptick. We had seen even before what I would call to definitely describe as a surge, not in the same way that we've seen in Minnesota or in other cities where you have a militarized presence that is profiling and grabbing people, but definitely a surge that is equally terrorizing, cruel, separating families, is violent, and is completely unacceptable. So we have seen so far through the statewide ICE hotline for reporting incidents that, yes, there has been a lot of corroboration that has been, we've also seen a lot of stuff, people in the community documenting the abusive behavior that's happening. So we have, ICE had put out a press release saying 39 to date, and I'm sure this number again continues to occur through the weekends and foreseeable future. I see so right now we have 32 families, people that we're working through, and it's what's striking is the way they're doing these operations is outside of the home because. These are not criminals. These are immigrant working class families. And they quickly move in, close, with unmarked vehicles, surround a car, in many reported cases they're pointing guns at them. And they have broken windows, taking people out. We have, at least four incidents of excessive use of force. And, people have been, parents have been taken away in front of their kids, leaving them completely traumatized. And it has been. And then what happens after that is then people are being quickly, and I mean quickly, moved out of Wisconsin to other detention facilities to make legal representation even harder. To date, I think one of the cases that was highlighted was of a Colombian asylum seeker and her 8-year-old son.
Yeah.
Only today was able to find out, because her attorney wasn't able to find out, but through the congressional office in Pocan, that she was in, still in some ways, thankfully, at the Dillon Family Detention Center in Texas. Mm. And so it's just one example of the extreme trauma and abuse that's happening, funded with our public dollars.
Christine, let's focus on your organization's ICE Emergency Hotline. What can you tell us about recent call traffic to this line?
I know that we have received, and this is maybe, a couple of days ago, 200 calls, and we have trained, trusted volunteers that staff this line, and these are volunteers who have been trained. We have it's multi language, so we actually pay for a service that if someone were to call in and speaks another language, there's an interpreter that can kick in, and it's something where we have seen a need to grow, especially for Spanish and English speakers, to grow this hotline, volunteer staff hotline, to be able to also meet the demand. We saw a little bit of a situation where there you call it in and then they call you back. But regardless, we're still able to kind of follow up. But we do want things in terms of good protocol to centralize through that, because it's a way of not of being more organized and making sure like we're not we're able to track what's happening in the families that are being affected. So it's always good, even if like there's a response, kind of an immediate response in terms of verifiers, that everything does get centralized through that hotline.
In our final moments together, I want to just focus one more time on the 39 people that the Department of Homeland Security said had been detained around Wisconsin, that they were, quote, had criminal histories, including sexual assault, DUIs, police obstruction, domestic abuse, and other crimes. What does VOSIS know so far about the people who have been arrested?
That's not true. We haven't, but we are still on an ongoing basis, and we work in clo very closely with SILC, based out of the Madison area, a nonprofit legal assistance organization, to like screen and try to help people. Obviously, many families, themselves, it's very key to try to get legal representation. The overwhelming, I mean, I have, the overwhelming, the basically everything I've seen so far is people who are going through, we're going through the asylum process. For example, in the case of the woman I just mentioned earlier, who just located today, like she had a pending, she was going through the asylum process and had an upcoming court date in next year, yet ICE is claiming that her court appointment was moved up and she was a no-show, which would make you arrestable. But a lot of the people, in some cases, someone may not have continued. So we're seeing people who are in the legal process, have no criminal record, and so there might be an immigration infraction, but the overwhelming, that I've seen have no criminal record.
Christine, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Christine Newman Ortiz is founding executive director of VOSIS de la Frontera. Now, to hear a perspective from the Milwaukee Common Council, we're joined by Alderwoman Marina Dmitrijevic of Milwaukee's 14th District. Marina, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
What can you tell us about this sudden ramp up of ICE activity in your city in recent days?
Oh, it's been absolutely terrifying. If you're going through the streets of the south side of Milwaukee right now, life looks a lot different. People are staying home. They're not going to medical appointments. They're not going to businesses. And people are really scared. And I don't think that's making our city any safer.
In April, the Common Council passed this ordinance that prohibits law enforcement, including federal agents, from wearing face coverings when interacting with the public. There's the Milwaukee County ordinance banning ICE agents from using city property as staging areas. Are these local ordinances being violated by ICE?
I am beyond disappointed that law enforcement itself is not following the laws and the rules that are on the books. Milwaukee Common Council united with the support of the mayor to have one of the boldest, strongest ICE out packages in the country, because unfortunately we thought this day might come, and we want our rules to be respected. It's what we expect. Our Milwaukee Police Department does not mask up, and I see no reason to have faces covered when it's 105 degrees out there.
Can the Common Council make federal agents comply with local laws? What recourse do you have?
Sure, I'm sorry. The Common Council is policymakers. We are not enforcers. That's the police department or the Office of City Attorney. And we have asked them to enforce the laws on the books.
What have they said in return?
ICE said, I heard this just through the media, that they were not going to respect that. So we are now exploring our options from here. But they cannot use city property to stage. And I just don't know why any law enforcement officer should be unidentifiable. That is scary. It's unacceptable. I don't think that people want it anywhere in their city or around the country. And, rather than looking at us and our policies that we passed, I think we should draw our attention to why those agents, federal agents, are choosing to mask up. What are they getting out of that by being unidentifiable?
Marina, the New York Times has just obtained documents that say federal immigration officials have detained more than 10,000 people in the last 5 days, amounting to a nationwide surge. What if this volume of arrests is the new normal by ICE? How could it impact your city?
We won't let that be the new normal. We must continue to organize. Voces de la Frontera, like I said, who was just on, has an amazing network. We will continue to fight to keep our families together. Our city is founded on the backs of hardworking immigrant families. For a child to see their mother or father torn away from them, that is not the new normal. That is not the America that we want. I know we're getting close to 4th of July. I want to celebrate an America that helps all families, all diversity. So we must stand up to it. We must push to keep families together. And I think that's a really important part of our history and needs to be a part of our future.
What do you want to see from local state officials to protect people living in Wisconsin from these actions?
Well, I just don't want anyone to give up or become complacent. It's easy in these times to become a bit hopeless. But we do have the energy. There was hundreds of people in the city of Milwaukee last night rallying in support of our families and our neighbors. These are our neighbors, people that we work and go to school with, people that produce a huge economic impact. And we must continue to keep people together and keep our city strong and safe. It's not safe when people don't feel comfortable going out of their house or calling the police or going to work or the hospital. So this is not creating any safer of an America for anyone.
Marina, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Marina Dmitrijevic is alderwoman for Milwaukee's 14th district. She talked with us about the recent surge in ICE activity in Milwaukee since last weekend. Earlier, we heard from Christine Newman Ortiz, founding executive director of Voces de la Frontera.
Coming up, funding that helped to keep child care centers operating in Wisconsin for the past 6 years has run out. Child care providers talk about how they're adapting.
We will have to increase our tuition.
Last time I raised my rates, I did end up losing two families.
That's ahead on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Farad. A small school district about 30 miles north of Green Bay is the focus of a sprawling legal case alleging the mishandling of sexual misconduct by school staff in Wisconsin.
Accusers in the case say Oconto Falls officials had deliberate indifference to the abuse for decades. Corrine Hess has more.
Throughout high school, Amanda Waska says she and David Heisel would go on long drives across Oconto County. Heisel would stroke Waska's hand, talk about his family's wealth, and promise to protect her once they were together. But they were not teenage sweethearts. Waska was a 15-year-old student at Oconto Falls High School. Heisel was her teacher. Waska now understands all of that was grooming, and she says it led up to a sexual assault her junior year.
It's hard to talk about. It's hard. I don't know that I've fully processed that yet.
Waska rocks back and forth and pats her left arm while describing the assault she says happened in 2012 during a student competition in Wisconsin Dells.
I know what has happened, and he did not stop.
Waska says Heisel followed her into a stairwell at the competition hotel, where he partially undressed and forcibly kissed and fondled her. In March, Waska and two other former students filed a federal civil complaint against the Oconto Falls School District, alleging the school district was deliberately indifferent to sexual misconduct for more than 35 years. The complaint has grown to seven plaintiffs with 19 sworn affidavits supporting their allegations. Heisel is one of a dozen staff members accused in the suit. The complaint says the students took decades to come forward because they were too young to realize the alleged conduct was predatory and criminal. That was the case for Watska.
From what I've experienced and what I've reflected on, I don't think that victims can come forward until they're safe enough to do so.
WPR reached out to attorneys, school officials, and members of law enforcement related to the case. None responded for comment. Chicago attorney Cass Casper is representing the plaintiffs.
I've never seen facts like this case ever in my practice.
Along with allegations from Watska, the complaint says another teacher was aware the assistant volleyball coach was sharing a bed with a student. A student was sexually assaulted by a basketball coach. Two fellow coaches knew and privately told him to stop, but did not report it. A student reported a classmate's sexual assault to a principal and athletic director and was told the school couldn't do anything about it.
The sheer scope of the suit and the number of witnesses who have come forward, in my opinion, reflects a severe problem in how these situations are being responded to, and we hope to rectify it through the suit.
Brianne Caravu joined the lawsuit on behalf of her teenage daughter, who she says has been harassed and inappropriately touched by teachers since middle school.
They silenced the kids. They silenced teachers. They basically made it almost impossible for anybody to come forward.
The attorney representing the school district has filed a motion to dismiss the case, arguing the district is not liable for a, quote, bad actor's conduct. But under state law, all school employees are mandated reporters who are legally required to report suspected child abuse or neglect, including sexual abuse. Tanya Jersey was a special education teacher in the school district for 11 years before resigning in 2015. She says she tried to report sexual harassment of female teachers to the school board, but the perpetrator was promoted.
Not only did they not do something about it, they defended the ones doing the damage.
Jersey also went to high school in Oconto Falls. Two of her friends are named in the lawsuit as alleged sexual assault victims of former basketball coaches.
When you're that young and unassuming and inexperienced, for an adult male to take advantage of that is one of the cruelest things that could ever be done.
Watska confronted Heisel last year in a text message. He surrendered his teaching license after the federal case was filed, but has never been criminally charged. Neither Heisel nor his attorney have responded to multiple requests for comment. Watska continues to pursue a criminal case against him. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is WPR News.
Funding that's been supporting child care centers in Wisconsin since the height of the COVID-19 pandemic expired yesterday.
The state's Child Care Counts program distributed federal dollars directly to providers to keep them afloat. In 2025, that program was extended for 1 year by the state through bridge payments funded through interest earned on federal pandemic funding.
The end of that funding could cause about a quarter of Wisconsin providers to either close or significantly reduce their services, according to a report from the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association.
Others will likely have to increase their rates. A survey released by the Department of Children and Families last week found that the cost of childcare in Wisconsin is already rising much faster than the rate of inflation.
Two Wisconsin childcare providers are here to talk about what they'll need to do to adapt to the end of Child Care Counts funding. Heather Murray is owner and operator of Art House Preschool in Wanakee. She's organizing Wisconsin's first childcare gubernatorial forum this month. And Jen Bilderbeck is administrative director for Big Oak Child Care Center in Madison and vice president of the Wisconsin Child Care Administrators Association. Jen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Heather, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Heather, these payments are ending. I understand you received your last Child Care Counts bridge payment for July. Now that you're not going to receive any more of this particular funding from the state or federal government, what will you need to do to adapt?
Well, I will be raising my tuition starting in August again. I've raised it 16% since 2022, and it'll go up another 3% in August.
And are you concerned, Heather, that raising your rates could price out some of the families you're currently caring for?
It's always a concern for me. Last time I raised my rates, I did end up losing two families.
And Jen, what's the situation like for you? What does the end of this funding mean at Big Oak?
We are in a very similar situation as Heather is. Like Heather stated, we will have to increase our tuition, and we usually do annually anyways under general circumstances with general increases to costs of our general expenses. But I think this year we will also have to look at an increase due to the lack of the bridge payments for our next fiscal year. We also are looking at different ways of and trying to be creative in potentially looking at, do we need to decrease staff hours? Are we going to look at options of less of raises, maybe freeze wages? There's a lot of different things that we're looking at and bringing to the table. But we have not made a decision on those things yet. But we know that they're there, and we know that we have to do something.
Heather, what is driving the costs for your childcare agency and others? What is it that's making this such a crunch?
Every center is different, but for my center, it's staff. I'm paying $18.50 an hour, and right now we're just barely cutting even. And if you want people who are educated to be with your kids, you're going to have to pay them a livable wage.
And Jen, are you seeing the same thing?
Yes, absolutely. Here in Madison, we are seeing the exact same thing. Our wages are anywhere from $20 to $25 an hour. And in order for us to maintain high quality staff that are trained and have their credentials, we do have to pay more. We also have to compete with other providers and competing with the school district for our 4K teachers too.
Heather, this whole child care counts funding started as a COVID era program, seen as kind of an emergency for I think obvious reasons. It's continued. The state picked it up for a while. How much of a difference did that funding make for you?
I always tell people for 10 years, I ran this business without that. And then when the counts money started, I realized I could actually run the business without having to worry about the financial aspects of it. And childcare counts also has proven to work and help all centers keep their doors open.
Jen, you are not just working with Big Oak, you're with the Wisconsin Child Care Administrators Association. This is not just a Madison-Wanakee issue. Can you talk a little bit about what you're hearing from your colleagues around the state?
Yeah, I would say the same. I mean, they're experiencing the same things that both Heather and I are, and some people more in urban areas are experiencing things more drastically in the effects that they can't pay their workers as much as we might be paying. So they are having a hard time keeping staff and finding staff to stay in child care centers. So I think when you look at the wages they were paying and able to pay with the assistance they were getting through bridge payments, and now it's going to be gone, that is going to be really, really tight. And that's where we're seeing some of the statistics of 1 in 4 centers potentially closing or having to modify things dramatically.
We're talking about the end of COVID era assistance for childcare providers here in Wisconsin. We're talking with two providers about what they'll need to do to manage those changes. Heather Murray is with us, owner and operator of Art House Preschool in Wanakee. Jen Bilderbeck, administrative director for Big Oak Child Care Center and vice president of the Wisconsin Child Care Administrators Association. Jen, when are we going to start to see the impacts of these payments ending? Is this something that parents will notice a difference?
Well, technically, we've all applied for our last payments in June. And so everybody that applied and qualifies will receive their last payments in July. So that will be coming in July. And I think what we'll start to see is a lot of centers getting creative, really trying to find that sweet spot of how much can I increase my rates? How much can I reduce my other expenses? Maybe are they going to cut down operational hours? And I expect that that's going to start happening in August and September. And then we'll start to see a trickle effect. We do know that there isn't any any sort of conversation in regards to some emergency funding or anything like that coming in. So then I think what we'll see throughout this fall and winter is some sort of bigger decline in centers being able to keep their doors open.
Heather, this is a state policy issue now. There's been a question, hey, will the state come through and fund this, pick up the funding again? They haven't. I understand you've been getting some visitors, Democratic candidates from governor coming to check out your daycare. What kind of things are you hearing from them? What kind of questions are they asking and solutions are they offering when they visit?
So they're all very, they realize childcare is an issue and it's something that they'll have to deal with once elected. They know that parents need accessible and affordable childcare. So they're talking about universal childcare or 7% of a parent's income. What we're trying to educate them about also is that providers also need to be supported because you can have you can have kids and parents who can get the childcare, but you have to have providers to provide the childcare.
Jen, what kind of ripple effect could a lack of childcare have further on down the line for the workforce, for the state economy?
Oh, a dramatic effect on our workforce. We know that if parents can't afford their childcare and have to make those tough decisions of one parent deciding to stay back home, we know then that is going to directly affect our state's economy. The ability for our state to tax an income tax helps sustain our state. And when you look at if it's going to be a one-person household going forward, we know that's going to dramatically affect our economy. So that's also going to be something that is going to trickle out as time goes on.
Heather, I've talked about to people about childcare as a business or nonprofit for a long time now, and it seems like even pre-COVID, I was hearing, you know, parents are paying a lot, maybe more they can afford. The workers aren't coming away getting rich out of this, right? It's hard to pay competitive wages. Do you see any kind of solution short of some kind of state or federal support to keep centers open and providing the quality that we want them to?
I just believe that the state investment, I don't think childcare can exist without state investment and on parents' tuition alone. And again, childcare accounts worked, and we didn't, we kept advocating for it, and we'll continue to advocate for that state investment.
Jen, has anybody come up, as far as you're seeing around the state, with a model that really can thrive without making cuts, without that kind of childcare counts or similar funding?
Yeah, there's a lot of conversation in regards to what might work. I just left a Wisconsin policy forum that I was listening to, and there are a lot of people involved in what our state funding sources could look like that may be able to help this investment in the future. We have states like Vermont, Washington, Louisiana, Massachusetts, they're looking at tax-based incentives. So things like payroll tax, capital gains, different net profits on or net proceeds on things like, can we look at if we legalize marijuana or looking at the overall income tax for the state? Can we look at areas like that maybe we could look at giving a certain portion percentage. And we're talking about percentages that are very small, payroll tax percentages that are under 1% to contribute to this, to childcare and help solve a lot of the financial issues with childcare. So I think we have a lot of states out there that we're working with and looking at to see what could be done. And I just hope hope that we can find something that will work. I think the important part is not to look at just one very specific thing, but maybe different levels of support within our state and federal government.
I'm curious about demand. Last time I talked to folks doing childcare, they talked about, in some cases, wait lists, just not enough slots open. Heather, what are you seeing for demand? Can you provide openings for all the parents who want them?
Right now, any child under the age of 2 in my center, I have a wait list until fall of 2027. And in my preschool room, it's about 6 to 9 months, probably, for a spot. And I know everyone here in Wanakee has some sort of wait list.
And Jen, is that common? Are you seeing that at Big Oak and your colleagues around the state?
So at Big Oak, we have a wait list, and our wait list is for only children under the age of 2. Right now, because of where we're located, we compete for our 4-year-olds through 4K with the school district. So when we have school districts that are very close in proximity, we tend to not fill with our 4-year-olds. And part of that, too, is also there is less and less of 3- and 4-year-olds that just exist in general. And there is a lower population of that age group. And so for us, what we are seeing is that infant care is in very high demand.
We'll leave it there. Jen, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And Heather, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Heather Murray is owner and operator of Art House Preschool in Wanakee. She's also organizing Wisconsin's first childcare gubernatorial forum this month. And Jen Bilderbeck is administrative director for Big Oak Childcare Center and vice president of the Wisconsin Childcare Administrators Association. They joined us to talk about the end of pandemic-era support funding for childcare centers here in Wisconsin.
Coming up, hundreds of magicians gather in Harry Houdini's childhood hometown for a once-in-a-generation celebration of his life and legacy.
He was a very well-respected magician of his time, and where else to host the convention other than in Appleton, Wisconsin?
The convention, Houdini 100 years later. That's next from WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Verrett. Hundreds of magicians are converging on Appleton to honor the life and legacy of Harry Houdini as part of the Society of American Magicians Convention.
While Houdini rose to fame after moving to New York as a teenager, he spent his childhood in Appleton, where he is still remembered as a hometown hero.
Here's the voice of the iconic illusionist and escape artist speaking to an audience in New York City in 1914.
Ladies and gentlemen, in introducing my original invention, the water tortoiseshell.
Yes, his original invention, called the water torture cell. It was a large tank filled with water that Houdini would escape from while locked in and hanging upside down.
The convention, called Houdini 100 Years Later, runs through Saturday in Appleton.
Dan Rodriguez is a magician and co-executive director of the Society of American Magicians National Convention Committee. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Excited to be here.
Dustin Mack is here as well, a historian and executive director of the History Museum at the Castle in Appleton. Dustin, welcome.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Dustin, let's start with you. There's this famous quip attributed to Harry Houdini that leaving Appleton was his greatest escape. How did Houdini feel about his childhood hometown?
Well, Appleton gets some flack for Houdini leaving. Houdini actually very much enjoyed his time here. It was an idyllic time in his life. His family was middle class, very comfortable. They were respected. And Houdini looked back very fondly on his time here and remembered it, writing letters and revisiting and even dreaming about it as an adult.
What were his first forays into performance as a kid growing up in Appleton?
So Houdini lived right on College Avenue, which for Appleton is our main street. And every summer before, you know, TV and movies and all this entertainment that we have today, the circus would come to town. And that was the biggest attraction of the year. And they would parade right down College Avenue past the flat where Houdini's family lived. And from seeing those parades come through and watching those performances here in Appleton, he fell in love with show business and he wanted to become, you know, a famous performer and have a piece of that excitement that he saw from the circus.
I bet that left a huge impression, you know, long before social media, long before screen time. That must have been a huge draw for him as he saw that.
Absolutely. It was the biggest event. The kids from the neighborhood got together and they put on their own version of a kid's circus. And Houdini claims that is the first time he ever performed in front of a live audience was here in Appleton as part of this kid's circus. He supposedly hung upside down and picked up needles with his eyelid during that performance.
Dan, you're hearing this. You helped plan this year's convention for the Society of American Magicians called Houdini 100 Years Later. What made you decide to hold this special centennial event in Appleton?
Well, this is the 97th annual convention of the Society of American Magicians. And back in the early 1900s, Harry Houdini was a member of our society, and he became the national president and was national president from 1917 to 1926 until his death on Halloween. And this is, of course, 100 years later, and where else to host the convention other than in Appleton, Wisconsin? So this is honoring the legend, honoring Harry Houdini. And that's why we're here.
The legend. How would you characterize Houdini's legacy in the magician community?
You know, he was a very well-respected magician of his time. And he was also he could perform illusions, sleight of hand, close-up type miracles. And then he actually was the person that thought of, you know, how about doing escapes and making that in a magical context, making that a big production. And so he really was the person, the forefather of doing escape magic. And his real strength was his marketing ability. Everything he did was a spectacle, and it brought out the media, it brought out the press. And even up to this day, magicians emulate Houdini in the sense that they create spectacle in their shows, just like Houdini did.
Has he influenced your own approach to performing magic?
Oh, well, absolutely. I've been doing magic for 40 plus years. And as a young magician, I wanted to do the straitjacket escape, and I did. And I used to do the tying the rope, 100-foot rope escape, and escaping from handcuffs. And I think every young magician does that, and they find their magic niche down the road. And so he did have an influence early on. And in fact, one of my first magic books was a book that Houdini wrote. And today, 40 plus years later, I still perform some effects that were influenced by Houdini.
Wow, what an impression that made. Dustin, Houdini spent roughly 9 years of his childhood in Wisconsin before moving to New York City with his family and starting his magic career. Why do you think Appleton continues to really claim Houdini as a native son and hometown hero?
Houdini has a special place here in Appleton, and they've always remembered that Houdini was a member of this community, but it really wasn't until the 1980s that he was kind of readopted as this long-lost son. So in the mid-80s, Appleton kind of got a Houdini fever, if you will, and Houdini Plaza, which is a park right in the heart of the city, was named after him. Houdini Elementary School. There were beers named after him in restaurants, and his movies were played. And that's when our organization, the History Museum, began collecting Houdini artifacts and memorabilia, archival materials, that sort of thing, and really promoting his life and his legacy and remembering his connection to the city.
We're talking about Harry Houdini, the famous magician who spent his childhood in Appleton, and we're joined by Dustin Mack, executive director of the History Museum at the Castle in Appleton, and Dan Rodriguez, co-executive director of the Society of American Magicians National Convention Committee. The Society is holding its annual convention in Appleton this week to honor Houdini's legacy 100 years after his death. Dan, what happens at a magician convention? Take us inside.
Well, it all starts the first night, and it's actually a night before event. And whoever our guest of honor is at each year's convention is kind of dedicated to that person and whatever type of magic that they were experts in, that'll be the highlight. Well, in this case, it's Harry Houdini. So we're actually doing a seance history event on the first evening of the convention's kickoff, and it'll be partially explaining how the seance began. And back when Houdini was passing away, he had this special code that he wanted to share with his wife if he could come beyond the grave. And there's a story behind all of that. It's very interesting. And every year a seance would be held. So the history of that seance will be talked about. And then on the second day of the convention, it's the Houdini Escape Show. And it's going to be actually held at Houdini Plaza. And there'll be a world record attempt. And there'll be Also, an upside-down straitjacket escape, just like Houdini used to do it. And that'll be presented. And there'll also be a Houdini's milk can escape that is one of his famous illusions as well. So those items are all about Houdini. But there are other parts of conventions, too. There are magic shows. Magicians love to watch magic. And it gives them ideas to influence their own performance. And there's also going to be lectures and experts talking about history of magic and learning sleight of hand and misdirection and stage presence. And then the third part, which is probably the favorite of most magicians, and that's the exhibit hall. And we'll have a couple dozen magic distributors. These are the folks that sell magic tricks. And they, the inventors of magic tricks will be there, and they'll be demonstrating their latest and greatest magic props and techniques. And all of that is all behind the scenes at a magic convention.
Okay, so zooming in on this world record attempt, paint us a picture here of hundreds of magicians in a group performing Houdini's famous handcuff escape, and the volunteers you need as well to help out in this moment. What will this be like?
Well, it is a challenge in itself. There'll be well over 300 magicians from around the world doing this challenge, and there'll be there's a chain that it wraps around their wrist. Each person will have the chain that wraps around the wrist, and then a padlock will lock those that chain in place, just like Houdini did. And 300 people getting in the chains at the same time, and when the whistle blows, everyone escapes at the same time. So this is all done in the open. They're not undercover. Their hands aren't wrapped. So you got to watch close. You might see how they do the escape. And hopefully all 300 can do it. And this is a world record setting. It's never been accomplished before at this magnitude.
Dustin, this 100-year celebration of Houdini, it doesn't stop at the convention. What else is in the works to honor Houdini this year in Appleton?
Right. This is a big year for all things Houdini. So the History Museum is getting into the swing of it. We're excited to host the convention goers as part of our celebration. And we're doing a series of Houdini in Appleton walking tours. So we'll meet on the museum's front lawn, and then we'll walk down College Avenue with our guides and point out kind of historic landmarks and, you know, memorable moments that occurred in Houdini's lifetime here in Appleton and share some of that history. And then Dan had mentioned the seance. And so later this fall, we'll do another walking tour that kind of recounts the, Houdini's foray and with mediums and the seances that were held after his death and their connection to Appleton as well. We also have an extra kind of special display for Houdini going on right now that showcases more of his handcuffs and his lockpicks, the tools that he was using as part of his escapes. And then some kind of rare artifacts that are documenting Appleton's re-embracing of Houdini and what that's meant to the community.
And Dan, Houdini's milk can escape, and there are other famous tricks. What is your favorite Houdini trick?
Well, mine is I do a comedy version of an escape, and I have audience volunteers put handcuffs on me, and then they raise this curtain, and it's not just a regular escape. And Houdini would do this with his straight jacket. Well, I don't have a straight jacket, so I use my own suit jacket. And so I'll have my suit jacket on. They put the handcuffs on and they raise the curtain and they immediately drop it. And my jacket is now on me backwards, but I still have the handcuffs on. So they raise the curtain, drop it. And now the jacket is half off and half on. And that happens three or four times. And it's a hilarious comedy skit, although it was all inspired by Houdini. And that's the amazing thing that Houdini could do is create magic that becomes a spectacle. And that's the closing piece in my show.
Dustin, you know, Houdini called himself this self-liberator. He was disciplined. He kept innovating his magic tricks. Are there life lessons outside of magic that we can learn from Houdini's story?
There sure are. The one takeaway I always am amazed by with Houdini is that discipline and the practice that he put into this. I mean, he was very clear with the public that he did not have any kind of superpower or magical abilities. He practiced. I mean, he was constantly working at his craft. Either it was a deck of cards in his hands or manipulating locks, handcuffs, whatever it is. There's a really famous story where a friend goes to visit Houdini just on a regular afternoon, and they're sitting in the living room talking. And in that time, Houdini has slid his shoes off, used his toes to take the laces out of his shoes. And then his shoes are just untied there in the living room floor. And the friend was just having a regular conversation. But that's how he got to be so dexterous and, you know, capable of making these escapes, is he was prepared for anything. And so that's something I think we can all take away, is if we want to be experts in our field, you have to work at it. There's no shortcuts.
Well, Dan and Dustin, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for letting us be here and share some of the stories with you.
I appreciate it. Looking forward to Magic in Appleton this year.
That is Dustin Mack, Executive Director of the History Museum at the Castle in Appleton, and Dan Rodriguez, Co-Executive Director of the Society of American Magicians National Convention Committee. We've been talking about Houdini's Wisconsin roots and his lasting influence on the world of magic. Houdini, 100 years later, runs through Saturday in downtown Appleton.
As we just heard, magicians are gathering in Appleton in part to celebrate the legendary Appletonian Harry Houdini.
And we want to hear from any magicians out there.
Whether you're a full-on performing magician or a hobbyist who's learned a few tricks, I mean illusions, let us know your story.
Card tricks welcome. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Hey, Rob, do you know any magic?
Sure. Watch me pull a rabbit out of my hat.
That trick never works.
This time for sure. Wisconsin Today producers include Beatrice Lawrence and Rochelle Wilson.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.